Hi, I'm Femi Oke. Last Saturday, an underwater volcano erupted off the coastline of Tonga. It blasted ash and stone into the air and also was followed by a tsunami. How are the residents of Tonga doing? Here's Wayne Hay with the latest.
Tonga was cut off from the rest of the world when the disaster struck. A submarine fibre optic cable was severed and will take at least 4 weeks to repair. In the meantime, some satellite phone and internet connections have been set up, allowing more footage to emerge of the devastation caused by the volcano and tsunami. For some family in New Zealand, the slight improvement in communication has come as a relief.
Even though everything, parts of Tonga, houses, it's been washed away, the crops, but we hear that our family and our friends are well at the moment in Tonga.
Okay at the moment, but what about in the future? Joining the stream to talk about the impact of the volcano on Tonga, Louise, Shane and Katie. I'm going to get them to introduce themselves to you, international audience. Louise, so good to have you here on the stream. Tell our viewers who you are and what you do.
Yes, I'm Louise Waterhouse. I'm the Honorary Consul General for the Kingdom of Tonga in Australia, and I've been in my role in a voluntary capacity for about 25 years or more. And so we've had exposure to this volcano going back to 1988, coming and going, but never been at this level. So it's quite an extraordinary situation we find ourselves in at the moment.
So glad to have you here on today's show. Hello, Shane. You're very welcome. Please introduce yourself to our viewers.
Maloe Ali. My name is Shane Cronin. I'm a volcanologist. I work at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. I've spent a long time working on Tongan volcanoes, and I'm working with a large team of international and New Zealand volcanologists trying to understand this ongoing situation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining us, and hello, Katie. Welcome to the stream. Tell our audience who you are and what you do.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Greenwood. I'm the head of delegation for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent here in the Pacific, and I work with all of our different Red Cross organisations right across the Pacific, including the Tongan Red Cross. I've been working in and around the Pacific for the last 15 years or so, and absolutely love it and pleased to serve with these people.
All right. So we have Katie, Shane and Louise and you. If you're on YouTube, you can ask them questions. They have so much expertise to share with you and experience. The comment section is right here. Join it and be part of today's show. I am wondering, Louise and Shane, what it looks like in Tonga today. Louise, you start.
It looks like a moonscape. We went from one moment of green, luscious coconut forestation to just a moonscape of grey ash everywhere. And I mean absolutely everywhere. The aerial photos is just everything looks black and grey. Even the airport was closed for 3 days and needed 100 people, including volunteers, to sweep it clear. And you can just imagine black soot being covering everything you have. Mm. All the islands of Tonga just covered in soot.
Shane, we're looking at some pictures
here. I don't want to sort of downplay how serious and terrible the situation is, you know, for the beautiful country of Tonga. But I was very relieved when I did see these images because there is definite impact, and obviously the tsunami and the ash impact has been massive. But it was so much. I feared actually for worse, given the explosivity of the event, and I feared there could have been even 10 to 20 centimetres of ashfall, for example, and it seems in the few centimetre range. So, you know, this is an immediate issue, but I believe that the recovery will be swift.
All right, let's talk about the recovery and the humanitarian effort. I'm going to bring in Quineda Clegg from the Humanitarian Network Council for International Development. I'm going to play her comment that she sent us a little bit earlier, Katie, and then respond directly off the back of it. Here she is.
This is a really tough and challenging emergency in Tonga. And with patchy and limited communications, we're really struggling to make contact with our partners on the ground. But what we're hearing from the Tongan government is that water, food and fuel is critical. And the Tongan government is also desperately trying to keep COVID out of the country. So the best thing people can do right now is support New Zealand agencies through cash donations, and that money will get to the communities on the ground who are delivering that critical aid. We know this will be a terrible crisis for many years to come, with significant and ongoing impacts to the communities of Tonga.
I think a lot has been said there, and it's absolutely right. There, everything in that conversation, right from the challenges that we face as an international humanitarian community in responding, have been a little bit unprecedented, particularly in the first 72 hours of this disaster, when we couldn't get in touch with people on the ground at all. And we just had to trust that all the preparedness and the training and the response and the pre-positioned relief supplies that we had on there and on the ground was going to do the job. And, you know, I think that a number of things have been said there. The challenge is also of the overlay of COVID. We do not want to be swapping one disaster for another at this particular point in time. And so the Kingdom of Tonga is absolutely right to have some of the protocols that they've got in place there around response. The other thing that was mentioned is the sort of the time range on recovery there. So we know that in disasters, we've got short and medium and long-term kind of response windows, and they're all critically important, but they all look slightly different from each other.
Louise, can you explain the water challenges for Tonga? Because I believe there are no rivers in Tonga. So when there is a tsunami or a natural disaster like the one Tonga's experiencing right now, how much water is there?
Well, that's the problem. We have most of the water is either bore water or through water tanks. And those water tanks have been polluted with the air, the ash coming through the air. So it's just an absolute disaster. We're trying to get water supplies in, and already yesterday New Zealand and Australia sent over emergency water. But we're also looking to try and find some water purification. And the thing is that, Simi, it's not just the water, it's the air quality. You can imagine the breathing in of this ash that's in the air. And fortunately, we sent a container of masks, 250,000, which were not needed for COVID, but maybe now they're coming in handy. The other thing which has been a disaster is the entire crop. The whole crop has been destroyed by the ash coverage that's come over the island. So you can imagine we have this immediate disaster of drinking water, air that you breathe, but also the ongoing disaster of food. We're just really worried about what's going to happen for Tonga going forward.
Femi, I think Shane and others have got some really good information for people on the water situation and how water can be treated in Tonga at the moment.
Yeah, go ahead, Shane.
Absolutely. And the water supply situation, and we're seeing from the pictures there that not only are the roofs damaged, but also many of the tanks damaged. So if there are water tanks that have been preserved and, you know, they're disconnected from the roofs, that water will still be safe to drink. And the bore water will still be safe to drink as well, but it obviously needs power to extract that. And because the ash, when it falls, it will cover plants and cause lots of damage to the green leafy parts of plants. It is not poisonous in of itself, so root crops will still be fine to eat. Taro, yams, kumala, other types of root crops, cassava, they will still be fine to eat, and obviously the leafy crops will be impossible. The water in of itself, again, is also not poisonous. There's not heavy metals there. It's salts, it's acidity. So under worst case scenario, you can drink that water. It may cause stomach upsets for children and people with sensitive stomachs, but it's just want to emphasize it's people should not be discarding water if there is a fear. You'll taste the water, it'll be metallic tasting, and that will be an indicator that there's a bit of acidity in there, but it is not inherently dangerous. And I just wanted to make sure that people weren't unnecessarily discarding water, and we've had some reports of that in other parts of the Pacific.
Oh, that's really important.
That is so good to know, Shane, because that's one of the things that's been stressing us in the community, thinking that the water would be not only polluted but poisonous. So that's such a relief. Thank you very much for sharing that.
There has been some indications that the volcano may erupt because there have been shocks. Am I right in thinking since about November? So that those yes, little, that's right. Those little indications that Tonga had to be ready, to get ready. Fred.
2020 hindsight's a great thing.
Yeah.
And so we're seeing now all of the signs that lead up to this large event. So we were seeing, obviously, over the last decades, there has been activity, but we were also seeing uplift of the central part of that volcano over the last 5 years, and in terms of corals being uplifted and things like that. Mm. And we also saw early evidence of this sudden eruptions, 30th of December and the 13th of January. So these were short-lived explosive events, and they were telling us that gas was building up in the volcano, the pressure was rising. We couldn't really tell from a day-to-day process when that was going to actually happen, though, because there is no monitoring on site. It brings us back to the point around the communications. The infrastructure is so poor in many of these South Pacific countries, and there is little support internationally to try and bring overlaying layers of infrastructure. We're talking communications, obviously, but also in terms of hazard warning. We have so little information to go on because there are no working seismometers nearby, and the team on the ground, I mean, there's a fantastic geology team in Tonga, Taniela Kula and his team at the Geological Services, they've been having to go out on boat to watch the activity of the eruption as it happens, which is really, really dangerous for them. It's also very difficult because you're reacting to a situation rather than trying to forecast it. So we've been trying to help Taniela and his team using as much knowledge as we can, and obviously international community has been pouring in here, where we've had people from the USA and the UK and all over the world that are pouring their knowledge into helping this through the
I've got some questions because our audience are very curious. So let me share this one with you, Katie, first of all. This one is on Twitter, and the tweet in response to our programme subject today: everyone seems to depend on cables and satellites. How about some good old ham radio? A must in such remote places. I mean, part of the anxiety of the Tongan diaspora is they don't know what happened to their family and their friends. Would radio, Katie, would that make a difference?
It already has made a difference in the initial hours of this response. So I saw that. I saw a tweet like that earlier in the week, and completely agree that we need some low-tech, low-expense, fixes in the mix in all of these places. So we did use HF radio in the early hours. Certainly that was used within Tonga itself when all communications went down. So like everything, you need a mix. High-tech solutions are fantastic. And when Shane was talking then, I was really reminded of the old adage of building back better. Mm-hmm. And as we do build back in Tonga after this disaster, I think, you know, we in Red Cross will be thinking about things like, do we need a VSAT on our building for Red Cross? Because that's in the days after this, that's the only way that disaster cooperation has been able to happen. And that's been shared really well by people who have it. USP, the Asian Development Bank and others, you know, are really helping out with that. But do we need that? Do we need, more radio technology so that if these things happen, people can communicate with each other? I think the high-tech solutions are fantastic, but we also need some low-cost, low-tech to be able to scale up our responses really quickly on the ground.
I'm going to put another question from YouTube.
Absolutely.
The
resilience of multiple technologies is...
I have so many questions.
The resilience of multiple technologies is hugely important.
Excuse me. I have so many questions for you, so I'm going to pepper them with you because the audience are really keen to find out more. This one, Louise, is from Chavance. This is a clear example of what happened to Tonga, of the necessity of disaster preparedness and for other states too. You were practicing. You were getting prepared. Was it enough, Louise?
I don't think it's ever enough, but yes, we're right. I think we saved lives with all the preparedness for tsunami, and the tsunami warnings and drills that have been going on in Tonga over the last few years have been definitely a great help. But yes, you're never prepared enough. But what I wanted to say also is, when we talk about connectivity and technology, the cable that connects Tonga to the outside world, that means to the Southern Cross cable that goes from Australia via Fiji to the States, that ran actually right alongside this volcano. So it couldn't have been in a worse position. So when we had the eruption, then, of course, the first thing to break was the cable, and it broke in two parts, one beside the volcano and the other in another area because it was sitting on a coral reef, and, of course, the coral cut through the cable. And the problem we have now is to repair this cable. It's going to take 3-4 weeks because we have to bring a boat from Papua New Guinea and obviously access in difficult conditions. So that's why we need to come back to simple technology and be able to go back to the old days when we could, you know, call without having a satellite or without having a cable. And I think it was a good point about the ham radio.
Femi, also the disaster preparedness angle that you're talking about is absolutely critical. And I think Shane said at the beginning that he was, you know, almost pleasantly surprised that the effects of the volcano and tsunami were not as catastrophic as we first thought that they might be when we were watching from afar. And I've definitely, you know, we have definitely had that feeling as well. We expected mass casualties. We expected absolute devastation. And, you know, to not have that, that's as a result of people knowing what to do, being well-informed, having well-coordinated people on the ground who have supported evacuations and the like. And that, you know, we've had pre-prepared stocks ready to for 1,200 families on the ground, ready to go immediately with the things that people need. That preparedness just cannot be underestimated.
There's so much fascination about
cultural memory.
There's
a deep cultural memory of disaster events around Tonga and the Pacific, and so people really respond well to natural signs. For example, when the water goes out before a tsunami, or hearing booms and feeling earthquakes, and so people are very naturally resilient. But the incredible ongoing efforts of organisations like the Red Cross and like the South Pacific Community and so on to keep bringing these messages through to the modern day is very important.
All right, I'm going to test your knowledge of volcanoes. I'm going to move on just a little bit, Louise. Do excuse me, I'll come right back to you. I want to bring in Heather Handley because there's a lot of fascination and curiosity about volcanoes, this underwater volcano. This is what Heather told us a little bit earlier.
What made this particular eruption difficult to categorise was that usually when we assign a size or a magnitude to an eruption, we use two main factors. These are how high that the plume goes into the atmosphere, but also the amount of material, the volume of material that's been ejected. And what was quite unusual about this eruption is that it was an extremely powerful eruption that produced ash and gas that reached at least 30 kilometres into the atmosphere, and current estimates suggest even as high as 39 kilometres high. But despite that, actually, it was a very short duration eruption and it didn't produce a lot of material that we would expect from a magnitude eruption of that power and explosive nature.
See, Shane, that's what Shane was saying earlier. Like, the devastation was not as bad as he was expecting it to be. Katie, you heard the volcano and you were where?
I'm in Fiji, which is 700 or 800 kilometres away from Tonga. And yes, we on Saturday afternoon heard this like booming sound, almost like cannon shots or loud thunder. No clouds in the sky, no reason. Our windows and doors also shook for about half an hour. And I just couldn't understand what it was. We actually thought there was a earthquake happening here in Fiji. And then all the alerts started to come through. So I can't imagine what the sound must have been like for people in Tonga.
Louise, what is it like when you see that footage? We're looking at the eruption right now. You know it's off the coastline of Tonga. Is that your biggest nightmare?
Well, of course it is. It is an absolute nightmare. And the curious thing about this is we've known about this underwater volcano and it's been popping up and popping down. And I remember back in 1988, the then king sent a boat out with a flag to claim this new island for Tonga. So we all laughed and said, now we have not 172 islands, but we have 173. So it's been a bit of a curiosity. We've never, ever thought it was going to be so dangerous as this. And now, of course, we know that this volcano is sort of on a 1,000-year cycle. That means that the last time it erupted with this magnitude was in 1050 AD. And we now know that it was actually due to erupt about now in the next decade or so. So it's extraordinary. It's been under our noses and coming and going over the last X years, and we've just thought of it as a curiosity.
Shane, excuse me for asking you as a professor to do a speed round on volcanoes, but I know you're up to it. I've got so many questions here for you. All right, so James Reedy, what is the current activity?
Yeah, good question. And I was about to say one of the most important things that we as a community of volcanologists are trying to understand now is what's going to happen next. So we've had our big event, and what are there going to be more eruptions? And that's the most important question we're focusing on. So currently, the New Zealand Volcano Science Advisory Group, with all universities across the country plus GNS Science, we're coordinating all of our knowledge and equipment. We have people and equipment standing by. As soon as we get ash samples from Tonga, we'll be able to start assessing whether new magma was involved in this eruption to trigger it, or whether it was triggered by stale old magma that's been sitting there and just expanding. Imagine like a loaf of bread inside the top of the volcano. As it sits there, it expands and puts pressure on the volcano and causes the, you know, extremely violent eruption that we've seen. Not only the magma, but also the interaction of that magma and water gave it that huge power. What we want to know urgently is there new magma that has caused that? Because if we can see the signs of that and we know how to recognize that, we've got specialized instruments at the University of Auckland to look at that. We will then be on alert for ongoing larger eruptions. We know from the geological record that some of these events occur with up to 10 or 12 different major eruption phases. You could probably say we've had, say, three larger phases so far. So we could be at the beginning of a longer story, and that's what we really want to know.
All right, Shane, can I ask you two more questions? Because I really want the audience to have your expertise. But you have to answer them in a sentence, Professor. All right, I heard the volcano is under the ocean. Did that help prevent worse damage, worse impact?
No, the other way around. If it was under 1,000 metres or more of water, it would dampen it. It was the perfect amount of water to mix efficiently. You flash water to steam and it blows up.
Jonathan on YouTube lives in Christchurch, New Zealand. He says there's a lot of activity in New Zealand. Should they be worried about an eruption anytime soon there?
These volcanoes, they're all on the same tectonic structure, but they operate on their own timescales. They have their own magma plumbing systems, so they're separate from each other.
One more cheeky question from Jay Jr. I admire your chutzpah here. Shane is a volcanologist. Why didn't he predict the eruption?
Yeah, I can certainly predict the eruption on a geological scale, but we wave our arms in the distance and say, hey, it could be in the next sort of 10 to 100 years. The problem is, on a daily scale, we need monitoring equipment, and we also need a lot more experience of understanding this particular volcano. It's a pretty tough science to call on a day-to-day or an hour-to-hour basis.
Oh, my goodness. I would keep you for the whole week to do a show, Shane and Katie and Louise. There's so much to talk about, but I really appreciate how much you've told us about the aftermath of the Tonga volcano, what needs to happen. I'm going to leave the final words of this show with Joseph Sikulu. He's the Pacific Director of 350.org. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next time.
The cleanup has already begun, and Tongans, like islanders all over the Pacific, are no strangers to natural disasters. Building the resilience of our people against the escalating climate crisis means that our people are already equipped to recover from this disaster too. The road to recovery will be a long one, and over the next few days, we will begin to fully understand the effect the ash from the eruption has had on our water systems and agriculture of our islands. As the recovery begins in Tonga, the rest of us Tongans around the world mobilize and organize to get all the support and resources we can back home. We will rebuild and recover. This is what we have always done.